to upset ocean equilibrium. Then it goes on to talk about where some of the places that this occurred, and in the next paragraph, the last sentence, about 1,000 miles from Honshu Island's Pacific shore, was struck by a tsunami averaging 41 feet high, but peaking in 7 locations as at more than 70 feet. And in one of those places, it struck with 125 feet in height. More than 28,000 people were killed, more than 9,000 were officially noted as injured, and more than 6,000 homes were destroyed.
Representative Hill has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've created a task force here. It's a legislative task force.
Yes.
In terms of, is there a reason why you chose a creating as a legislative task force rather than putting a task force in the Office of Emergency Management in terms of to create an action plan? Because the best that we can do is deliberate and come back with legislation. Is it something in terms of that, if we were to stick it in a requirement in the Office of Emergency Management, they could actually implement something in the interim? In terms of, they could come up with an action plan to then execute?
When I had this idea of drafting a bill, we went to the Legislative Council with the idea of an interim task force. They came up with the language that they did, which is standard language for creating an interim task force. I would not have a problem with it being handled by an agency. We've talked about this. We've talked about maybe the port districts, the counties, the Office of the Emergency Management would be great. I think it's important that we have a coordinated effort, because there have been bits and pieces done. If that would serve the purpose, it would certainly be less expensive. Part of the problem with this bill is that the fiscal impact for a standard interim task force would be significant, and we are looking for ways to avoid the high cost. So I would certainly entertain putting it within an agency that's currently working on this and has a broad jurisdiction. My concern is that it have legislative recognition, and that the findings of this task force be recognized by the legislature at the next session, and that the recommendations that are made by this interim task force be taken seriously by the legislature. I think that in the past there have been bits and pieces done, and the coordination of it is actually the most important thing. So if it is better served being within the emergency management operation, that would be great.
I'm sure. I guess what my concern is that we're going to go out and we're going to have a legislative committee looking at tsunamis, and then we're going to have legislation, and so it's going to be a span of 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm curious in terms of, I'm trying to understand in terms of what the likely outcome of this is going to be. Is it going to be that we should install a system? To me, it's like, let's go direct to Office of Emergency Management to come back and tell us how much it would cost, rather than figuring out whether it needs it to be there or not. We just sort of do a leap of faith and suggest that, yeah, we should have it. Let's go find out how much it costs and how we can do it, and then figure out the governmental entities that align along the coast in terms of how we should apportion costs and what portion of that cost the state should bear,
mm-hmm.
in terms of, so we have a uniform system up and down the coast. I'm just trying to understand in terms of what the likely outcomes are here, so we drive to a conclusion. And I'm assuming the conclusion is how we're going to pay for this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the likely outcome that I anticipate is that there would be broader participation than would normally occur. I think the lodging industry absolutely must be involved, because this could strike fear into the hearts of people who want tourists to keep coming to the coast. And I think part of the purpose of the task force would be to include people from the tourism industry to determine what kind of educational material would be put out, and also to locate the high ground. Now, this could be done within that office, I guess, but I'm just afraid it would be too narrow an approach. So I would be happy with a bill that would designate a agency that would be, you know, the umbrella, but I would like language that would say final implementation. Whatever couldn't be done during the interim, there would be a report back to the legislature and some requests perhaps as a result of that study to the legislature. Now, I anticipate a lot of different ways of funding the outcome. Federal dollars, for instance, are available. I think you have a piece that says Oregon State University received a large federal grant to study tsunamis. And so there's a lot of pieces out there, and this is an attempt to just bring them together.
Madam Chair.
Representative Brown.
I think Representative Hill and Representative Morissette, the development along the coast has been over the last 20, 30 years or since the last time there was a tsunami there, has been a lot of it has been in the low-lying areas and the tideland areas, really in the bays, and so they're subject to a great deal of, should another tsunami happen, then there's going to be a great deal of destruction, even to the development that's taking place there. And I think what you're trying to get at, and I don't know how we accomplish it, but that we need a uniform warning system up and down the coast that will protect the tourist industry and all the people there and give them directions on how to reach the high ground and to as much as possible. And how we get about that, come about that, I'm not sure.
Yeah. May I, Madam Chair? Yeah, I think that's the main purpose of this, is to draw together the people, the many, many, many experts who live on the coast and involve them in helping in solving the local problems, but to coordinate into a larger piece. So there is some uniformity, and I think that's the important thing. And to part of that task force would concentrate on the educational piece. How do we get word out to people? How do we do it without frightening people away? I mean, this may not happen for another 100 years, but it could happen as we speak. So that's my request, is to put together a group that is officially recognized by the legislature and is given a task to find some answers, make some suggestions, and come back and report, and to implement anything that they want to implement in the meantime. That's fine. I mean, we're not requiring that they report back before there's ongoing implementation of what they're already doing, but I do want to have the recognition that we think this is important.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I guess my mind, you know, it should be led by emergency management, and we might apologize. We ask the gentleman from emergency management back up. I'd like to understand what's occurring today in terms of what we could deliver in the interim, because one of these things, we do these task force, I'm more interested in coming back and what proactively can they do in the interim versus study and deliberate and then come back and then it's another 2 years before something actually really occurs, and trying to shorten the time frame for action.
Right.
I would suggest that, you know, we look at getting represented from two coastal cities, you know, two coastal counties, in terms of so we distribute the representation along the coast, and that one of the things that we ask them to come back with is a plan for funding the system. And you know, I'd just say let's just take the leap of faith and just declare that, yeah, we think it's necessary to have a coastal warning system. Question really is, how do we pay for it, and what are the funding options that, and how is that, and what should the apportionment of that be, you know, from the governmental entities along the coast, so in terms, you know, in the state, so it's federal, state, and local dollars, and then how, you know, the answer coming back to the legislature is, what do we need to do in the next legislative session to enact this to occur, you know, I mean, that would be my suggestion, and find out in terms of, are there dollars they have today to do tsunami that they could help fund this effort, and it's all moving forward. But it also suggests that we include representation from the government geospatial data center over in DAS, which is the GIS group, which could help understand, and they could, through computers, tell us where the high ground is, so we don't have to go out and do a big survey. It should be pretty simple. And if we get the right people with the right data set, you can speed the whole process up and then come with an action plan, you know, how to communicate as an outcome of this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you could, if you would, ma'am, Madam Chair. I'm not sure he's still here, maybe.
Is Jeffrey still here?
Hold on, Mark is here.
We have three other people signed up, so.
Anybody from emergency management is still?
Yeah, Mark D'Arienzo. Did I say that right? Thank you. If you'd like to come forward. Representative Morris, do you know if Representative Hopson wanted to testify?
I believe she did, and I'll.
Okay. Okay.
Do you want to call the others up?
Yeah. Have a seat. Arnold Husing and Stan Gibson on the other side to testify. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairman Smith. And members of the committee. My name is Mark D'Arienzo. I'm the Earthquake and Tsunami Program Coordinator for the State Office of Emergency Management. And our name is on the task force, or our name is proposed to be on the task force. And I think George Priest of the Department of Geology, he talked about a lot of things of what we've done previously within the warning and evacuation area, which this bill addresses. And I just wanted to more or less introduce myself. So, you know, you can connect a name with a face, and like I said, we've done quite a bit. And what I did was I prepared a little summary sheet that discusses our accomplishments in the warning and evacuation area and in the educational area. And that'll give you kind of a good summary of what we've done and what we hope to accomplish. And so I know that we're very interested in helping the communities on the coast to create effective warning systems and effective evacuation systems. And we do a lot of our work through the Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program, which is a national program that we've been funded for the last 5 years. And it's hard to say what's going to happen in the next 5 years, but we've been funded every year for the last 5 years, and we hope to continue to be funded. And
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, is that a grant that you applied for, is it?
Well, no, what it is, it's money that comes out of NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and it's money that comes each year, and it goes towards several things. One is it goes toward the tsunami inundation maps, these computer-based maps. Another, it goes toward these offshore buoys that can tell when the tsunami is traveling across the open ocean, and it reduces false alarms. And then some money goes to mitigation. So that money goes and is split up. If we have meetings twice a year, it goes and gets split up at that meeting, and we've been getting the money every year, I think about $2.3 million every year, and it's split up between these different parts of the program. And I think as far as mitigation, the states get about, we've been getting about $50,000 over the last couple of years, and then some of the money goes to multi-state pots, which do various things, make education materials that could be used by all five states. It also went to a creation of a tsunami warning systems and procedures guidance document, which our office helped develop, and we have finished that, and that's going to be the basis for the tsunami workshop, a warning workshop in May of this year in Portland. And then we're also planning on a local warning workshop in the fall and the spring of next year to bring in the Oregon people and discuss what our needs are as far as warnings are concerned. So we're really very active in the field of warning and evacuation. But this money is 100% money that comes in from NOAA, and it comes through, and then we make plans of how to use that, and we get locals involved. And we've been producing evacuation. A lot of that money goes to evacuation maps for the coastal communities, and also it went toward the creation of this warning document. It also is going to pay for the tsunami warning workshops that we're going to have this year, as well as early next year.
Okay. You said you developed a guide, so we know what the warning system should be.
Yeah, what the guide was designed for to do was to look at the pros and cons, look at all the different systems that are out there, and then look at the pros and cons of each system, throw in some estimated cost for those systems, everything from sirens to telephone ring down systems to NOAA weather radio to other systems that are out there, and try to compile it, look at the pros and cons of those systems in this document. And the document is essentially, it's a living document. We've finished it, and we're going to be probably updating it after this workshop in May.
So, Madam Chair, so if you're going to go and implement a warning system, you've already, you know, the cream has risen to the top, you're going to say this is the warning system to go implement?
What we're doing is we're more or less not saying what's the best, because I think that when you look at many states, what they have, they already have things in place. I think the idea is to try to get help the communities that haven't got any systems to try to look at what's out there, what they can look at, you know, prepare to, what they can use, maybe implement in their other agencies. But also we try to, in this document, look at the bigger picture and say, is there a potential for uniformity within these systems? In other words, can we take these systems and try to make it as uniform as possible, whether it's uniform as far as the sirens? But if you have all sirens, maybe you want to have a certain sound, you know, within that, without Oregon, that people understand when they go from place to place, you know, that this sound means to do something and to look and to do something and then take action. And then, it, you know, could be all hazards. One siren sound could be all hazards. In the case, turn on the radio and then get information. So we're trying to look at different ways of trying to make sure this thing is uniform in the best way possible. And it may not be easy to do that, but that's what the guidance document is designed to do.
Done, sir. So is this, you know, a 18-month project to figure out what that should be? I'm trying to reduce this down
okay.
to,
yeah.
you know, are we to the point where we can implement, or do we still need to deliberate and investigate? I mean, are we at an action point now, or I'm just trying to understand.
No, what we're trying to do is with these workshops, they're more or less workshops where we have breakout sessions that are designed to get people to talk about, is there potential for uniformity? What are the pros and cons of the different system? And try to get different five-state people to engage in conversation. Then what we're going to do after that is we're going to have our own workshop, bring in the local people and decide what is good for Oregon. And that's going to be either in the fall or early, or maybe in the spring. But we're planning it tentatively for the fall. So hoping that within these workshops, we can come up with some concrete suggestions about what Oregon is going to do. And that's why the workshops were designed. And so from that point of view, that's something that's different from the task force, but the workshops are designed to bring local counties together to decide what's best for Oregon and what our needs are and where do we go from there. So I think the task force, you know, could be part of the process of the discussion and be very, you know, be part of that discussion of what's best for Oregon.
Madam Chair, I might. So is there an end point to this? In terms of, is there an action plan at the Office of Emergency Management that by January X of 2000 X, you know, every county along the coast and every community will have a tsunami warning system in place?
No, we don't have that. We haven't got that far. Okay. As far as a point within 5 years that everybody has a warning system.
So, if I'm Madam Chair, so what are we lacking to just get to that point? In terms of where we say we're going to go do this, we may not understand how we're going to pay for it, but we have a plan that says by this time it's all going to be there. These are the players along the coast. You know, this is what the whistle will sound like. I mean, is that done by September or?
I think that after this workshop we'll have an idea. So I think next year, by the end of next year, we'll have an idea of what our needs are.
Any other questions? Let's move on. Thank you. Go ahead. State your name for the
record. I am Stan Gibson, the fire chief of Coos Bay. I have a prepared document that we will pass out to you folks of my testimony. But sitting here listening to Mark talk, I think that what we're looking for is probably communications, commitment, and cooperation. Our community has taken the position that we have put in a warning system. It's not a system that we're 100% comfortable with. We would like to see it more in the community. However, funding is an issue at our local level. My perspective as a local emergency planner and emergency responder is that we need to have the cooperation of both state and federal agencies. And that seems to be, we have that currently, but you're asking for a plan, and we sit here and hear them say that it's going to be a period of time before that plan is here. and we would like to see that moved forward because we have no idea of when this event could take place, and the impacts on our area would be very dramatic.
Any questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ano Husing. I'm the director of the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association. We're a nonprofit that works for cities, counties, ports, and soil and water conservation districts up and down the Oregon coast. I plan to testify today with Wilbur Turnick, so Wilbur, why don't you join us right now? And okay, well, I was there the evening when Representative Morissette was in Florence at an LCOG meeting, and Wilbur Turnick has just walked in the room, more or less explained to the LCOG board members that made the suggestion that communities on the Oregon coast are not prepared for a tsunami. So I've been very close friends with Wilbur Turnick for a number of years, and we've talked about this extensively in the last several days. I think you've received testimony here that a lot of very good work has been happening since the idea of what a threat this is, as the scientific community has told us about that, and so a lot of good work is underway. I would, of course, point out, though, that the funding at local jurisdictions is extremely shaky. I mean, all of these cities and counties on the Oregon coast are facing budget shortfalls, most of them. So to turn around and ask them to do a whole bunch of new stuff is a very difficult thing to do. I do think, though, that Wilbur Turnick and Representative Morissette have really put their finger on something that's very important, which is to establish some kind of uniformity in a system. And I think Representative Hill has done a very good job of pushing us to think about, okay, what are, building upon all this good work, what are the remaining things that need to be done, and how can we push ourselves over the edge of having something in place that's going to provide that uniformity up and down the entire Oregon coast, and something that visitors to the coast, not just the low, you might have a system in one community that is good for that community, but if you're filled with visitors, it's hard for them to know what the system's all about. I was going to ask Wilbur to... Oh, I'm sorry. Why don't I follow up Wilbur's testimony, because Wilbur's been the lead on this, and
okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
For the record,
snuck up on me
there. Okay. Yes, my name is Wilbur Turnick. I'm just a private citizen here today. I'm an unelected official. I live in Florence, Oregon, and was born in Astoria and raised on the Oregon coast, and outside of a short period of time over in the South Pacific during World War II, I've been on the Oregon coast and worked on coastal problems up and down from Santa Maria, California, into British Columbia. I also, in the past, as the chairman of our coastal commission, that's one of the reasons why I'm here today, and the long drive from Florence. I'm very concerned that the possible earthquake damage and the tsunami, as we sit here today, a good share of the people in my city may be dead. The earthquake can come at any time. And what I've written in my testimony and talking about that, and I realize it's maybe a little too much, but I, like other people in this room, have experienced being days and weeks in situations where we were surrounded by dead people. We were surrounded by dead corpses full of maggots and flies. And I'm using that to illustrate what can happen on the Oregon coast. If you look in my testimony, you're going to find two sheets prepared by Dogme with predictions. 8.5 magnitude earthquake, 2 deaths in Lane County. I can tell you from my perspective, that's totally ridiculous. That kind of a thing, if we're going to get a 26-foot wave with where we've got our retired people live who are old and very, very wonderful people that we're getting into the Florence area now, most of them want to be next to the ocean. During the Alaska earthquake, what did I hear? We stayed in our home. As the 6-foot wave came up the river, everybody was running down to the beach to watch the wave. And despite everything that we're going to be able to do, a certain percentage of those people are going to do that same thing again. some of the older people are going to stay in their homes thinking they're safe. If we get the 500-year event, look at that figure, 18,000 people dead on the Oregon coast. It's staggering to even imagine the chaos that's going to happen. In Newport, Jim Good has now developed a plan that they're entering into. And it's got the sequences of what can we do for 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. I think it's one of the best approaches that I've ever seen. Am I interested in 50 years from now? Not really. I'm not going to be here. But my grandchildren will be. That plan is based on possibility, as you can see in the earthquake damage book prepared by Dogme, that most of the Oregon coastal bridges are going to be gone. So they're relying on getting the relief help in through the ports. Well, guess what? While I was in the water experiment station, when I was working on a research project, they gave us a demonstration of liquefaction. All of our jetties, the jetties at Florence, massive big rock structures that would allow you to come into that bar, are situated on 100 feet of sand over bedrock. Those jetties are going to disappear with liquefaction. They won't even be there. And you won't be able to get in that way. We're going to have to rely on the same kind of infrastructure that we had in World War II and they had in Vietnam, and that's helicopters. Are they there? I don't know whether they're there or not. Not in the numbers that we're going to need by any means. If, in fact, we were talking about a situation that was we were assured wasn't going to happen for 100 years, it'd be fine. Yesterday, I called every fire department and every city on the Oregon coast that I could get a hold of. Seaside tells me they're going to have a 50-foot wave. If you've been to Seaside, a 50-foot wave is going to overrun the whole town. Other places tell me, no, no, it's just going to be 26 foot. Some cities have been told that there's going to be a 100-foot wave. If there's a 100-foot wave, then we've got most of the people on the Oregon coast wiped out. One of the other things that hopefully somebody will look at, South Beach State Park, maybe 1,500 people in that park. The earthquake and the tsunami happens at 2 o'clock in the morning. Is anybody there to let them out? There's only one entrance, one exit, and it's located right behind the foredam. And if that happens, then what? Most of those people are going to drown because they're not going to get out of there. Beverly Beach is even worse, where the two children drowned the last time in the last earthquake. So what I'm making a plea for, and by the way, our departments tell me they don't even have the money to buy the sirens. I was on a port commission for 29 years, and I did a lot of stuff with surplus. There's no way that anybody can tell me that there isn't a U.S. surplus depot somewhere in a warehouse so full of sirens that you can't believe. And those sirens need to be one sound for the whole Oregon coast. In the summertime, our population doubles. It's going to be real weird for somebody driving up the coast to hear one sound, a siren in one place, and one in the other, different sounds, different lengths of time, and that's what's happening now. Manzanita's going to have loudspeakers because it's situated so they can do that and cover the whole town. Others are going to blow their sirens for 10 minutes. Some of them are going to blow them for sequels of 3 minutes. That's utter chaos to have that kind of a situation on the Oregon coast. We need to have one sound. We need to get those sirens from some federal surplus and make them available to every fire department on the Oregon coast. And we really need the help now to have stockpiles of emergency supplies somewhere in a safe location in every community. I wanted to say one other thing, too. I realize I'm probably taking too much time.
Yeah, we're running short on time, but you go ahead.
This is a foreding. That's the buildup of sand. I don't think we're sure. This happens to be on the class of plains. This is a recent phenomenon of nature that we have that was caused by man with beach grass that was introduced to the Oregon coast. We have massive fore dunes from one end of the Oregon coast to the other. And all over the world, it's recognized that port dunes are your first line of defense against a tsunami. It breaks up the energy of the wave. Yeah, the last earthquake, big one in Japan, the fore dune saved massive damage, and I saw the pictures from it. When the wave was over, the fore dune was still there. Now we have a situation where the Forest Service in the Oregon Dunes is destroying fore dunes. What for? For nest. Maybe they'll get three more nests for the snowy plover. My idea is that people come first, and the safety of our people, whether they be my grandchildren or your relatives on the Oregon coast or tourists, are much more important than two little birds in a nest. There are places where they're doing it now where it's safe, but that kind of destruction of fore dunes is prohibited by Goal 18, and it should be, and that kind of thing should not be exported to where we're going to have a disaster.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The breakthrough at Bay Ocean, until 3.5 million yards of sand washed into that estuary and destroyed the upper two-thirds of the bay. That same scenario can happen again if we don't pay attention. I don't know whether the committee, the interim committee, is the total way to go. I know that Dogney and the Oregon Emergency Services have done a splendid job. Long has been doing the same thing. And every community on the coast is trying real hard. But we really do need to have some immediate action to be prepared for what's going to happen. And again, could be 5 minutes from now.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yeah, just very briefly, when Wilbur was talking about all the dead bodies, that was in Okinawa.
Oh,
so
thank you.
Put that in context. And I've heard wonderful accounts of that incredible experience he's had, and he's perhaps the man most responsible for founding the organization that now I'm the director of, so I owe him a tremendous debt of gratitude. I'm not exactly sure whether the task force is the way to go through this. I think we're getting close, though, to a stage where we can put this uniform system in place. As Representative Hill pointed out, we need to identify funding sources. People on the coast don't have the money to go out and start doing something, so we need to define what is realistic and find the sources. I just want to let the committee know we cohabit in Newport with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. We work closely with them on this. I pledge the cooperation of our association to make progress in this area, whether it's a task force or not. We'll assemble this information, and hopefully next session we'll have not just what to do, but how to do it figured in place. Wilbur, you were going to say one last.
Just one other thing for the committee. This is an Oregon Earthquake Handbook written by a man by the name of Vern Cope, and maybe there's others. This little book, I don't know who's going to do it, but that book should be bought, and it should be placed in every school and every home that we can get it into on the Oregon coast. It's a how-to on how to survive on the earthquake. It explains it thoroughly, and, you know, it's not going to cost a lot of money to buy that thing and distribute it, but it needs to be done.
Actually, the California transplants that moved to the Oregon coast, they're the ones that are active in the community saying, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Where I just came from, we had all this drills and this and that, and so they're probably the most aware, of course, group of individuals on the Oregon coast that are working. But knitting together all these things would be a very good idea, and I thank Representative Morissette for making us all confront the need for a uniform system one way or another, whether the bill becomes a task force or not.
I better thank Representative Morissette, too, because without him bringing this to your attention, I don't think it would have happened, and I really appreciate that. I appreciate the time you've given me.
Oh, thank you for driving up here. Any other questions? Representative Jones?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, recommendation. I think in terms of the way this is crafted today, might go back and look at some amendments, and then with the fiscal cost on it, we need to get into Ways and Means. Maybe in Ways and Means they can look to see if this could be melded into Office of Emergency Management. The dollars are already being used in terms of have a discussion down there about them driving an action out of this rather than deliberation in terms of so we actually get a plan as to how this is going to occur and they can cost out what the system is so that we can then figure out what the apportionment of the cost ought to be across all the governmental entities.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on HJR 56? If not, I'll close the public hearing on HJR 56, and I think what we're going to do is wait on that because it's going to bring it back. Thank you. move into a work session on House Bill 3382. This is for purposes to do that.
No.
For purposes of referring a bill to the House Full Funding and Tax Fairness Revenue Committee.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I move House Bill 3382 to the House School Funding and Tax Fairness Committee without recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Oh, call roll call.
Representative Benton.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Savoy.
Aye.
Representative
Cruz. Aye.
Representative
March. Aye.
Representative
Lomay. Aye.
Representative
Worth. Aye.
Vice Chair.
Aye.
Thank you.
No, now you close the... I don't know if they're receiving the...
Say yes.
House Bill 3382, having received the required majority, is moved to the House School Funding and Tax Fairness and Revenue Committee. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3382. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 3556, which we had before. And Harrison Conway is here to bring us up to date on the, is it Dash 2 amendments?
Yes.
Dash 2 amendments. Harrison, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, Harrison Conley, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I believe in your last meeting you had testimony from, I believe it was Judge Mabry from Wasco County. He mentioned that he had his DA communicate with someone in Washington County in the DA's office. I believe in your staff measure summary you had some concerns with the original draft from that DA in Washington County. I've had an opportunity to talk with that person, and there's been a lot of communication back and forth between the two DA's offices, and so we've cleaned up the language a little bit here. I think it was discussed that there's some ambiguity in the provisions for county sale and conveyance of property. Part of that is various ways of referencing local governments. We talk about political subdivisions. We talk about counties, cities, districts, municipal corps, public corps, quasi-public corps. Those issues play a role. Also, in the original language, I don't have the bill in front of me, but in the original language of 275.030, there's some discretion granted to the county related to the sale and conveyance. Well, no court has ever construed that language, and it's a bit ambiguous. What it says essentially, if I can paraphrase, is that when the county finds it in their best interest, they may sell and convey by means of a sheriff's sale. Well, what is it that's in their best interest? Is it the best interest to sell or convey, or is it the best interest to sell or convey by sheriff's sale? It probably is the former. When it's in their best interest to sell, they must use the manner of a sheriff's sale. So what we've done in this language in subsection 2 that we're adding is to clarify that when the county deems it not in their best interest to use the sheriff's sale, they may use other means discussed in Chapter 271.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just for clarification, those are the Dash 2 amendments.
Right. Dash 2 amendments.
Yes. Madam Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 2 amendments.
I have a motion to move the Dash 2 amendments. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I move House Bill 3556 to the floor to do pass recommendation and move that the subsequent referral to the Committee on School Funding and Tax Fairness / Revenue be rescinded.
I have Representative Cruz has moved House Bill 3556 to the floor with the due pass as amended. Dash 2 amendments and the subsequent referral to the Committee on School Funding and Tax Fairness Revenue be rescinded. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Conley?
Sure.
Mr. Conley, I was just wondering if there's been any difference in your strength that you've noticed since the last time you were before this body.
Chair Smith, Representative Tomei, I find that the Samson story is only one half of the energy that can be contained in hair. I thought that the energy that was contained in that particular set of hair was negative, and I feel much stronger for having gotten rid of it.
Delighted to hear it. Thank you.
No follow-up?
No.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Do I have any objections to the motion before us? If not, call the roll, please.
Representative Beck?
Aye.
Representative Brennan?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Savory?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Congress? Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 3556 be placed on the consent agenda. Calendar.
I guess the chair wanted me to ask if I can carry the bill, if you would withdraw your motion.
If you would like to carry it, that's fine.
I really didn't have to, but Chair Crummell thought I should.
Madam Chair, I will object to the consent calendar.
Okay.
Thank you.
You can carry it.
All right, there we go.
The motion has been withdrawn, Representative Hill?
Well, he objected.
Oh,
so.
He objected. No. The motion, House Bill 3556, having received the required majority of pass, moved to the floor with a good pass. And I will carry the bill myself, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3556. Thank you, committee.
A pleasure.
We're going to move into a work session on House Bill 2153. Meg Reinhold.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, after a very long and exhaustive schedule of meetings with a number of the parties on this bill, I believe that all the parties have agreed to the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2153, and I'll let Meg talk about them a little bit.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Meg Reinhold, and I'm with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which is the department in charge of the Building Codes Division. The Dash 5 amendments basically do two things to the original bill. And as you may remember, this bill is the result of an interim steering committee, which we had, which included all the players in the building codes diaspora that we work with every day. One of the elements is to allow all our different boards, the plumbing board, electrical board, all the boards with jurisdiction over penalties, to have consistent penalties and systems in which they administer those penalties. So the timelines will be the same, the amounts will be the same, so that people coming before those boards, and as well as our staff who administer those boards, it makes their job a little bit easier. The other thing this bill does is change, the amendments change the bill so that local governments are required to have a compliance program that is intended, a program intended to verify licenses.
Madam Chair?
We.
Can you point out to me the Dash 5 amendments?
That's Section 15, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Representative Hill. Line 31 on page 4.
The state is in charge of issuing various licenses, and local governments that assume programs, building code programs, all this would require them to do is to develop some sort of a program that's unique to their local government that would be the intent of which is to allow them to verify that those licenses are indeed in hand when they're out on the job site doing their inspections.
Any questions? Bill Foss, did you want to say anything on this? Bill, you're done? We're fine.
I'm just trying to see, Madam Chair, trying to find the language.
Representative Hill, it's page 4, line 31.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay. I see what I'm looking for. Madam Chair, this is just a strange question. I've never quite seen amendments drafted like this before in my time here. They're drafted as gut and stuff, but then they're going back and amending the actual printed bill, because the way this is written, I mean, I don't see where it's... Somebody could just point out to me where it's repealing the language in the printed bill.
I don't believe that all the language in the printed bill is being repealed. These amendments are additions to the bill. And the renumbering that you asked for is in Section 15. You'll notice that, say, line 23 on page 4 deletes the 1, and the Section 1 to Section 16. Line 29 changes Section 2 to Section 17, and so on and so forth.
I've just never seen amendments drafted like this.
They're very long and complicated.
We do things different here.
Using,
I agree. We
form I've never seen before.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they've changed their form and style, how they do amendments.
Madam Chair, Representative Hill, we recognize that same complication, but we have verified that it all works.
We have a motion for the
National. Well, just one more question. So we can assume at this point that the original bill is basically intact with inclusions. Madam Chair, I would move the -5 amendment to House Bill 2153.
Have a motion to move the -5 amendment. Do I have any objection? Any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
No.
Okay.
Go ahead. Now we just need a motion.
Right.
Well, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2153 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I have a motion to move House Bill 2153 with the -5 amendments to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Deck?
Aye.
Representative
Hill?
Aye.
Representative Corey?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Mitchell?
Aye.
House Bill 2153, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Court Safoy, would you like to carry this bill?
Representative Beck really wanted to.
I think that Representative March is really wanting to.
I'll volunteer.
Representative March will carry the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll ask questions.
Thanks.
Work session on House Bill 2153 is closed. Okay, public hearing. I'm going to open a public hearing on SJR 32, and that will tell us what it's about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Resolution 32 urges the Department of Administrative Services, the State Court Administrator, the State Treasurer, the Attorney General, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to place automated external defibrillators in state buildings and public places under their purview. It urges cities and counties and other local governments to place these AEDs in government buildings and public places.
Thank you, Matt. We have two people signed up. Dick Wilkinson from the Red Cross and former Representative Bob Montgomery. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dick Wilkinson, and I'm on staff with the Oregon Trail Chapter of the American Red Cross up in Portland. I'm here this morning to speak to you concerning Senate Joint Resolution 32, which, as you just heard, declares legislative support for placement of automated external defibrillators, also known as AEDs, in public buildings and public places. The Red Cross and the American Heart Association believe that widespread availability of AEDs will help save lives of people who experience sudden cardiac arrest. This bill does not request any funding. Our goal is to raise awareness about AED use. Last session, the legislature passed a Good Samaritan law covering AED use by lay people who are trained. Currently, there are two AEDs in this building, one located in visitor services and one in facility services. Excuse me. What we're talking about this morning is truly the only life-saving treatment for over 250,000 sudden cardiac arrest victims in this country every year. The treatment is defibrillation and has been used by trained medical professionals for over 30 years. Today, the technology has evolved to the point where non-medical professionals, such as lay responders, people just like yourselves, can provide this same life-saving treatment with a device like this and a little bit of training. I'd just briefly like to show you how this particular device works. If you were to respond to a victim who had no pulse and was not breathing and you had a device like this available, you would bring the device to the victim. Upon arriving, you would push a green button, which is the go button, which would turn the device on, and you would be instructed to connect electrodes. The electrodes are located with the device, and these are the pads which would be placed upon the victim's bare chest. Proper positioning is on the victim high right and under the rib cage on the left. If there's any question in your mind as to where they go, you can look at them. There's diagrams on them that show you where they go. Once these pads are in place, the unit will sense the circuit has been completed, will tell you to stand clear, and will go into what's known as an analyzation phase. This is where it's actually looking at the heart to see what the heart's doing. What it's looking for is a heart that is not beating in a normal manner, but is in fact in fibrillation, which means it's going to look like this. Okay? We're not pumping any blood here. The victim is unconscious, truly. When it senses this, and only when it senses a heart in fibrillation, will it then say, shock advised, stand clear. There'll be a brief warning siren that lets you know that the unit is charging up to shock levels, and then you would be instructed to push the button and deliver the shock. This is what it actually sounds like.
Connect electrodes.
This is where it's asking me to place the electrodes on the victim. Once that is completed, the unit will sense it.
Stand clear.
Tell me to stand clear.
Analyzing now. Stand clear.
You want to stand clear so it doesn't pick up your heartbeat if you're touching the
shock advised.
We found a heart that is in fibrillation. It's charging up to shock.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
That's it. We just delivered the shock.
I felt it.
Now, when this procedure is done in a hospital setting, the success rate, and understand when I say success rate, I'm talking about the survival rate of the victim, is about 90%. When this very same procedure is done outside of a hospital setting, the success rate, again, survival rate, is about, actually, it's less than 10%. How do we get from saving 9 out of 10 victims in hospital to losing 9 out of 10 victims out of the hospital? The answer is in the amount of time between the onset of the cardiac arrest and the application of the defibrillation treatment. In a hospital where you have trained staff on hand 24 hours, where you have devices like this readily available, and where most likely the victim is being monitored in some way, shape, or form prior to the arrest, they're typically defibrillating in 2 to 3 minutes. Outside of the hospital, defibrillation only occurs, one, if the arrest and the collapse is witnessed, and after 911 has been notified, after the responding emergency services arrive on scene, and after the paramedics have the opportunity to prep the victim. If all of what I've just listed takes more than 5 minutes, chances of survival for that victim have been greatly diminished.
because without respiration to take oxygen into the lungs, without circulation to move the oxygen to the vital organs, neurological damage will occur begin occurring within 2 to 3 minutes. If we do CPR to the victim, and this is why CPR is still important, we can expand that time window from 2 to 3 minutes to 4 to 6 minutes. And that's why those first 5 minutes are so critical.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any questions? Great testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Montgomery from Cascade Locks. I'm here representing myself. Last week, we had House Bill 3338. Two of the members of the committee were here. I will be repeating some of what I said last week, but please bear with me. I'm here in support of SJR 32. On October 22nd last year, my 12-year-old grandson, Graham Jones, passed away from heart failure while swimming at a public swimming pool in Beaverton. He was a very healthy young man. We didn't realize that there was any problems at all. We'll never know, but had one of these defibrillator things, and believe me, 2 years ago I didn't know what a defibrillator was, let alone being able to spell it. He may be alive today if one of those things had been at the pool. We're now aware, after much checking, that our 10-year-old granddaughter has the same thing that our grandson has. I asked for House Bill 2302 to be introduced. It asked for defibrillators to be put in every new construction in the state of Oregon that comes forward. He didn't mention the cost. I believe these are $3,500, and they'll be coming down as we get into more production of them. And I believe there's 2 or 3 manufacturers in the United States of America now, so it's not a one-company deal where they have a lock on the market. SJR 32 would be a good start. I still feel every building should have it. My main reason for coming forward today is to let you know that it's not only old people that have heart attacks and heart failure, it's young people, and it happens a lot more often than the public is aware. Generally, this is getting out more and more. My son-in-law has dedicated his life to making people aware of what our youth are putting up with. Twilight and Hills and Park Recreation are in the process of putting them into most of their facilities now. They're working on it. It'll take a little while. And I found out that Nancy Riles School in Beaverton, through the courtesy of a Dr. Olin, has put one in their school. And as you've seen, it's not a difficult thing to operate. I think with all due respect to my companion here on the left, a monkey can operate them after they're trained. So it's very easy to operate, so there's no excuse not to have them. I thank you for hearing the bill, and I request you pass it on and vote for it and get the governor to sign it. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Sure. Mr. Montgomery, you mentioned House Bill 3338. What did you tell us about that bill?
I'm sorry, I don't hear too well either. As old people.
You mentioned House Bill 3338.
Yes, it was in the Health Committee this past week. Chairman Cruz was on the committee, and it did pass out, I believe, to the floor, and it should be coming up probably this week, early next week, I believe. Madam Chair, Representative Cruz could probably...
Yeah. I believe I was the chief sponsor of it, actually. Representative Kefauri, what the bill does, what our bill did, was direct DASC to develop a plan for the placement of defibrillators in all state buildings, come up with the cost, and bring it back to the next legislative assembly for implementation. So it was very point specific. I think this is a good companion piece, basically saying that the Legislative Assembly is in support of what we have already asked DASC to do in another piece of legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I close the public hearing on SJR 32. We have to open a work session on SJR 32.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hill.
I move SJR 32 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Have a motion to move SJR 32 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any objections?
Discussion.
Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Kefauri.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative March.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Ward.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Don't declare that.
Having received the majority, declared passed, Senate JR 32. Representative Clore, would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
She does.
Since I feel like I can get off the hook until I offer to carry it.
That's right.
You got it. I needed something.
Carry your weight here.
Close the work session on SJR 32 and open a public hearing on HB 3735.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3735 requires the city to publish notice of public hearings regarding comprehensive plans in a newspaper of general circulation.
All right. Do we have testimony? We do. We have Randy Tucker and Linda Ledwig. Just come together. Or do you want to leave?
Bring them up together.
Thank you, Mr. Tucker.
Be faster that way.
Yeah. You want to get out of here.
That's right. Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker, for the record, Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. 1,000 Friends of Oregon supports House Bill 3735, and we thank Representative Cruz and Representative King for sponsoring it. This bill is a straightforward housekeeping measure that simply requires cities to do what counties are already required to do, which is to notify the public prior to holding a hearing on an amendment to a comprehensive plan. Most cities generally already do this, but while it is required in statute of counties, it's just a loophole, actually, that cities are not required to, there's no provision in either statute or rule that requires cities to notify the public prior to hearings on amendments to their comprehensive plan if those amendments don't affect the actual zoning of land. For example, a city that is considering the expansion of an urban growth boundary might hold hearings on revisions to their population projections, their land supply, land need elements of the comprehensive plan, and because those amendments don't in themselves change the base zoning or limit the use of land, which if they did that, they'd require a Measure 56 notice, they might very well lead to a subsequent UGB amendment, but they don't, no notice is required. ORS 197.610 and 197.615 already require notice to the Department of Land Conservation and Development when a city proposes and adopts an amendment to a comprehensive plan, but notice to the public is conspicuously absent in these cases. So House Bill 3735 simply takes the statutory wording that already applies to counties and replicates it, inserts it in ORS Chapter 227 for cities. As you know, Goal 1 of Oregon's Land Use Planning Program establishes that citizens have the right to participate in decisions that affect them, including plan amendments, and that right to participate can't effectively be exercised unless citizens are given adequate notice of public hearings at which plan amendments are considered. This bill simply corrects an oversight in the current law, and we would urge its adoption. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Tucker?
Go ahead, Linda. Linda Ledwig, the League of Oregon Cities. As many of you already know, but some of you don't, the League represents 238 cities across the state, and of course we support public notice. But I do have to ask here the real question: what does this bill really accomplish? As you heard from Mr. Tucker, Measure 56, cities are required to give individual property owner notice for zone changes and comp plan amendments. Generally, for comp plan amendments, which the bill addresses, the hearings phase comes after several months of study and meetings with neighborhoods and businesses and property owners. Generally, no one is surprised as the plan changes enter the formal hearings process. Really, the question here for us is one of value. How valuable is it to inform the entire community of a change in one part of town, and how many newspaper notices will be necessary? The bill says with each public hearing, many changes require one, two, or three city council meetings and planning commission hearings additionally, since the council must act on planning commission's actions as planning commission's recommendations only are recommendations. So should local government be obliged to notify property owners through the newspaper when it only affects a small amount of the community? And is the legal ad in a newspaper the best value to inform the public of comp plan amendments? In many jurisdictions, property owners that respond in writing or attend city council meetings, planning commission hearings for these comp plan changes ask to have their names included in mailings and are currently notified just as affected property owners would be. Another concern we have is of newspapers. Hopefully many of our smaller communities around the state actually have newspapers of general local circulation. Otherwise, we could be spending a lot of dollars without appropriate infiltration of the message. We have a concern with the continued hearing provision of the bill. City councils meet twice a month, every 2 weeks. A 10-day notice actually means a 28 to a 35-day delay between continued hearings. And this provision would probably best work if it was only applied to first hearings. Since we do currently do individual noticing, a consideration would be a posting on the Internet, I think, rather than the newspaper. I would also like to point out the provisions of the county code that Mr. Tucker referenced were implemented and put into statute prior to the Measure 56 noticing provisions to individual property owners. And the Goal 1 reference, open meetings, public participation, notice, access to public records are already well covered in Goal 1. And local governments do have to have local standards to meet Goal 1. LUBA can remand a comp plan amendment if Goal 1 is not followed. Lastly, I just want to point out some fiscal impacts. Currently, many jurisdictions do this, but there are fiscal impacts associated with the bill. And we have estimated it was about approximately $600,000 per year statewide to do the newspaper notice as provided in the bill. So in summary, although the league supports the public noticing, we're not sure that there's a whole lot of added value here that's worth the extra cost, especially when state and local resources now are very slim and the value gained by this seems fairly small. When you take in consideration what we're currently doing. So, questions?
Yeah, Linda, city council meetings or planning commission meetings, you have to give notice to them now, don't you? I mean, that's public meeting law. This is just additional information in that notice. I'm not sure how you come up with this impact when it's just part of a notice you're already required to publish.
The impact would be if we're giving an additional separate notice. Representative, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, may I make one small comment? The bill does say that if, in case the action concerns only part of the city, then the notice only needs to be published in the territory so concerned. Realistically, obviously, there aren't always little sub-newspapers for sub-areas of the city, so I understand that. But that's all the bill requires there.
I guess, Madam Chair, I don't see where it requires a separate notice. It just requires notice. So it would be in your normal publication. So that's why I question the fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, many of our small jurisdictions and our smaller newspapers, the city council meetings and planning commission meetings, basically just put in a calendar of events on the side that the newspaper publishes for free. They don't actually individually call out specific agenda items on that noticing. And it appears to us that the bill would require those smaller jurisdictions to actually insert a legal notice calling out a comprehensive plan adjustment, amendment, or change. And that's, I believe, where we would see the additional cost to our smaller jurisdictions.
Representative Hill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I don't know if in terms of the sponsor of the bill. One of the things I always look at when we do these things is to make sure that we stick some language in there allowing that option of also or requiring if the city is operating a website, put information out there as well. Might do is look at reducing what the notice is and referring to where they can get all of the documents in a cheaper manner. I mean, I think in terms of I know in my area, and you know, if you're in Portland, it's very expensive to be printing public notices in the Oregonian. And so if we can reduce the requirement to its sort of irreducible minimum, give a URL, you know, where they can go off and do it. Recently, it was like 60-70% of Oregonians have internet access today. And so, I mean, more and more of a viable means to get copious amounts of data out there for it, and that may help reduce an overall impact cost rather than having to sort of print a long column of data explaining what the comprehensive plan is, but just doing notice that there is a comprehensive meeting change and where they can get the information on the specifics. I don't know if that satisfies you for a better Oregon or...
Madam Chair, Representative Hill, if I understand you correctly, as long as the notice says that lists the item that's going to be discussed, or at least says, you know, that there will be a plan amendment proposed of the following type, and that the full documentation can be obtained elsewhere, then that's fine. If it just says there's a city council hearing and you can get the agenda on the web at this site, then that doesn't necessarily give notice of the item, right?
I'm thinking in terms of you can call out. The thing, and then it would reduce the cost to cities down so they wouldn't have to print all of the summary of what the comprehensive change. I'm thinking what I'm assuming the cities are talking about is all the data needed to print. This is what's going to occur. We can say public notice, there's going to be a comprehensive change, you know, this, you know, sort of a very short summary. The full details can be somewhere else. That really reduces the cost down significantly. That would be required.
Madam Chair, Representative Hill,
the city operates a website that they could put the other data on. So I think in terms of otherwise, you have the language that says a short summary.
Madam Chair, Representative Hill, a couple of comments. First of all, that seems reasonable to me. Second, I also would like some more information about the proposed cost. This is something that, as I indicated, counties are already doing, and the language I have right here, I'd be glad to share with you, is identical to the language that's proposed here. Third, your comment about the expense of advertising in the Oregonian, Representative Hill, obviously that's true. When I spoke to Representative Crummell about this yesterday, he went through the bill carefully to make sure that in Wilsonville, for instance, you could place this notice in the Wilsonville Spokesman, which goes to everybody in the city, and you wouldn't have to put it in the Oregonian, which goes to people outside the city that might be concerned but are not in the jurisdiction. So I think it's currently the costs, I would imagine, are reasonable considering the benefits, but certainly be open to a discussion of, to, you know, language that offers that opportunity that you're suggesting.
I mean, the argument I would say in terms of understanding the cost of those types of things is Hillsborough has Hillsborough Argus, and now the city of Hillsborough is much larger, and I think you could go and make a case that says their service territory is not the footprint of the city of Hillsborough because the Hillsborough has moved so much. So under this, one could go and argue, well, you didn't advertise in the Oregonian,
right.
And therefore you didn't give ample notice, and that changes the dynamics significantly. I know in other statutes, where we talk about notice, it reduces it even farther down by talking about a paper published in the cities or something, so that you don't get that kind of an issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Hill, this bill does the same thing. It says, advanced public notice of each of the hearings is published in a newspaper of general circulation in the city, and that satisfies the requirement. So if somebody's outside the city and they care about what happens in the city and they don't get noticed because they aren't in the city, this doesn't give them the opportunity.
I'm looking for the concept of, you know, I could take the Argus, and because it's not a paper that normally is in eastern Hillsborough in terms of what used to be Washington County, they didn't really have circulation out there. One could say, nip it down, they're in the city of Hillsborough, and Hillsborough is publishing in the Argus, and then if somebody comes in and says, well, you didn't give ample notice because this is not a paper of general circulation in the city, the only one that would have that definition would be the Oregonian. I mean, it used to be because I'm just sort of looking where they circulate
right.
And where their service is. I mean, they may argue with me about
that. Right. I mean,
I think a case
I don't know.
That says the only paper that it was of general circulation got the entire city is the Oregonian, and then the cost goes way up.
Madam Chair, Representative Hill, I don't know how, say, Luba, for instance, would respond to an argument from somebody saying, I live in Hillsboro, and it was in the Argus, but that's not a newspaper of general circulation in Hillsboro. I have no idea how that would come out. That's what this bill does is it gives people grounds to challenge if there's a failure to notice, to challenge it in Luba. And
I'm trying to alleviate grounds.
Sure.
Because I think making it, you know, we give a notice and responsibility. I mean, that's in terms of when in the city, in terms of we have to post in the, you know, in the courthouse. In terms of, it doesn't mean that we have to go and distribute leaflets to everybody's door. I mean, there's a responsibility for people to take action and understand what's going on in their city. And I think in terms of we need to balance that requirement for people to be active and involved without having to sit there and go out and take a poll every time we want to make a change. I think in terms of how do we do that, I understand what's going on here, but I'm mindful in terms of the issue, and I look in my area that's growing, and you really don't have a dominant newspaper, save the Oregonian, that covers all the area, and I would probably say that they don't publish in the Oregonian, publish in the Argus. So.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I have a question. In Corvallis, of course, we do leaflet every single door for every single thing we do. And Measure 56, you know, I can't even tell you the amount of the budget that notification takes up, and I think we certainly overdo just in case. And so my question was, is first of all, what is the requirement for the public meetings notice? Isn't it 3 days? And what's the time period requirement?
Madam Chair, Representative Worth, I believe it is 3 days.
So if this would require 10 days, it would be an additional notice. And from what I'm reading here, this doesn't preclude the notification being done by mail, TV, or radio. So if a jurisdiction is currently leafleting every door for every possible action the city may take, then that would be covered. If we're notifying for comp plan amendments currently by mail only to those affected areas of the city.
Madam Chair, Representative Worth, my reading of the bill is that it doesn't mean that you can't do those things. It doesn't restrict a city's opportunity to do those things, but that failure to publish the notice in a newspaper of general circulation would violate this provision here. You need to publish it according to this provision. The only cases where it's probably I guess I should explain where this came from. My colleague, Sid Friedman, who staffs our Salem office just down the street, the Willamette Valley office, was monitoring a UGB expansion process in McMinnville. And that process has several steps that I described earlier, projection of population, land need, et cetera. And he was just trying to keep track of all those things and wanted to find out what the requirements are for notice so that he'd be able to just watch the paper and show up. He found out that for those preliminary elements of the decision, even though they might determine the outcome of the decision, there was no requirement. So that's what we're trying to get at, is sort of cover that loophole. Obviously, we'd like to do it in the most cost-effective manner possible, and we thought that using the exact same language that already applies to counties would be the logical thing, because it doesn't seem to have caused any crisis in the counties as far as we can tell. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like the concept of the public notice. I think it's crucial to have citizens involved in the process. I'm a little concerned about some of the smaller jurisdictions where they might have a weekly paper at best. And how do we balance all those things? And, you know, is there a different time frame? Is it 3 days? Is it 7 days? Or, you know, because you've got the initial hearing and then you've got subsequent hearings and getting notice to a paper that's only published once a week, and how does that play out? you know, I'd like to think about this one a little bit more and maybe explore those. But we need to get a process where the public has an opportunity to be involved from the beginning. And so, you know, how we get there.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Pardon me.
Thank you.
I'm going to close. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I'm just wondering if, Linda, if you would be willing to work on some amendments that might make it easier for cities to follow this.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, absolutely. Yes, we could do that.
Great.
This is such a shining example of my ability to work with 1,000 friends. I'd hate to see this go away.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz has been carrying our water all session.
Yeah. I guess Representative Hill, I mean, you know, to have notice with reference to a website, I think it has some merit, and I think that's something to look at. As far as weekly newspapers and stuff like that, I don't think that jurisdiction ever has an emergency expansion of an urban growth boundary. It's a planned thing, so that's just logistics, and I think that's workable. So I would be more than happy to see what the parties could come to as far as way of amendments and modification.
Thank you.
Patty, can I make one comment? I would say that, you know, the thing that would help public notice the most and public information outreach would be to make those public notification things more understandable. Because I get a public notice in the mail, and I've been on Planning Commission for years, and I still grapple with it. I mean, that's the most...
Keep the lawyers out of the process.
It's the most... People can't understand what that means. And even when you say, hey, we gave you 23 notices about the UGB expansion, you say, I never got a notice about that. So I think it's so difficult for the, you know, any person to understand.
Did away with
advertising. He wants to be a millionaire.
Thank you very much.
I'm going
to close the public hearing on House Bill 3735, and I thank the committee very much for being here today.
You did good.
Thank you.
Six, Madam Chair?
I'm sorry?
We're doing...
We have no one to
Randy.
Testify on it here. So we're going to continue that on. Seeing no further business before the committee.
Nice job, Chair.